It is good to be back in the saddle again. There is light. There is light that you cannot see. Light is electromagnetic radiation. And we actually live in a world that's full of electromagnetic radiation. It's all over the place. Photons. And photons behave both like particles and like waves. Many of you have probably heard this before. Photons behave like if you were to take a bunch of rice and throw it out, particles. But photons also behave like waves, the way that waves move through water. Photons behave in these two different ways. And photons are the evidence that we have electromagnetic radiation. There's kind of a disagreement, argument, what is an actual photon? But what you can say is a photon is evidence that electromagnetic radiation is present. Now, really high energy electromagnetic radiation is things like gamma rays, X-rays, and UV rays. These can actually penetrate human beings and do damage to our DNA, change very basic things of who we are. Skin and tissue can be damaged by this. X-rays will bounce off of bone structure and come back to a special camera that reads those photons coming back off of the bones, and that's how you get your X-ray picture. If you keep slowing down the frequency just a little bit further, you come into the visible spectrum of light. So X-rays are actually just light that you can't see, but if you keep slowing it down, you get frequencies that we can see. Violet, you can see that. That's the fastest frequency that your eyes can see. And then you have red is the slowest frequency that your eyes can see. So you can see a tiny spectrum. There's a huge amount of really fast, high-moving, high-energy frequencies that you can't see. And then if you go beyond red, you get into infrared, which is slower, bigger waves. If you go beyond infrared, you get into microwave. This is what vibrates water particles in your microwave to heat your food up. It's just light. Your food is heated up by light that you can't see. If you go past microwaves, you get into radio. You get into AM and FM. FM first, it's a little bit shorter and a little bit faster than AM, but they're both huge compared to the tiny little spectrum that we can see of visible light. AM and FM radio, they're light that has sound modulated into the wave. So that light is actually transmitting sound across miles, across much further miles even. Light that you cannot see can even transmit sounds that get kind of encoded, modulated into the wave. We see such a small spectrum of the reality of what light is and what it shows in our world. We can only see. I had the pleasure of reading a book by a man named John M. Hull. He writes a book called Touching the Rock, as well as others that speak about what it means to be blind. He became blind at 45 with young children. This was a huge change in his life, of course, but his writings on what it means to be blind are life-changing. They have formed and shaped the way I think about my ability to be sighted and what it means to be unsighted. And his writings help us to understand what the psalm writer in Psalm 139 means when the psalm writer said, "Lord, darkness is not even dark to you. Darkness is like light to you." I think previously I would have thought, well, that just means God has really great night vision. But John Hull's writings make us realize that there's something more going on here, that God doesn't need visible, just that tiny spectrum in the darkness isn't like our vision, just a little spectrum of light. God sees so much differently than we do. Should I be grateful for John's disability? His disability enabled me to see better than I otherwise would have. Being sighted as I am, there isn't a way for me to experience darkness like he did. He had to change the way he thought about facial expressions, body language, attractiveness. He had to rely so much more on sound, touch, and smell. I am grateful, although I wish, of course, he never was blind. I'm very grateful. I live in that dichotomy. I'm grateful for all the help that others give to me, to help me to perceive, to help me to see all the light that I cannot see, so that I can know how better to follow Jesus. Thinking of this, of the light that we cannot see, I want to look at this text about the healing of the blind man. First thing I want to do is I want to talk about our sermon series. Our sermon series for the season of Lent. How does this text fit into that? And then I want to talk about the brokenness of the world. And then lastly, why does this healing take two touches? Incredibly weird, right, that this man could not see. So first, the sermon series. We're beginning the sermon series for Lent. Lent, as Chad said, is the time of preparation, looking forward to what it means to go through Good Friday again and to prepare our hearts to receive Easter again. What we want to do is we want to follow Jesus on the way that he leads us. Now, why would we have to learn to follow Jesus? Isn't it easy? Don't we just, well, Jesus says do this, and so I do it, and Jesus says do that, so I do that, and Jesus says don't do these things? Is that how we follow Jesus, or is it more nuanced, complex, more different than simply do or don't do? It seems that we do need to learn how to walk on the way. And so the sermon series for this time is called On the Way. And perhaps you know Monty Python, and you know of the ministry of silly walks, the different ways to walk on the way. We're going to look at the Jesus way to walk, which is not a silly walk. It's a very good walk. Now, the disciples knew Jesus, and they walked with him, and they were touched by him. He saw them daily. He would say to them, go and do, and they went. And he would say, go and speak, and they would go, and they would speak. But they failed to follow him when the rubber hit the road. They failed to follow him at the cross. Completely. How can we hope to follow along the way that they were unable to? So I want to pay attention to the special section in Mark that's known as the way section. You see, Mark begins the gospel of Mark by saying, as it is written in the prophet Isaiah. And then he proceeds to quote Malachi. And so you're wondering, what is Mark doing? Well, he's saying, take the whole gospel under this picture of Isaiah. And like good biblical scholars, all of us know that Isaiah has the picture of a new exodus because the people were in exile in Babylon. So Isaiah has a vision from God about a new exodus that's coming and how that's going to happen. And in chapter 42, verse 6, Isaiah says that he sees this redemption coming as a leading the blind along a path that they do not know. Well, Mark has picked up on this. And in chapters 8 through 10, Mark uses this language of the way. He begins this section with the healing of a blind man, and he concludes it, framing it with another healing of another blind man. And in between, multiple times he'll say, on the way. And Jesus left there, and he went on the way. There's multiple times where there's on the way used, and so Mark's way section has a very specific teaching in it that Jesus is trying to teach both his disciples and us. And it's on the way to Jerusalem. So this is important teaching that Jesus wants to give his disciples before the final conflict in Jerusalem. In this teaching, in this way section, there are three pulses, three waves, if you will. And they are around Jesus' declaration that the Son of Man will be crucified, died and buried, and will rise again on the third day. The disciples go with him on this way, and this is what Jesus is trying to teach them. He tries to explain to them that the Son of Man, that he himself, has to be crucified. You, of course, maybe remember that Peter's first response is, no, Jesus, say it's not true. That cannot be. God forbid it. So Jesus is trying to teach them something that it's very hard for them to receive. This is our journey in Lent. We're trying to follow Jesus along the way and learn what it and to rise again. We need this. We so very much need this teaching. You've maybe noticed that we live in a world that runs counter to the way of Jesus. We live in a broken time, politically and emotionally and spiritually, and we so desire for things to be made right and good. Now, we're not the first people to desire things to be made right and good, And what seems to happen is that the desire to make things right and good leads us to try to make it so that those who don't do what's right and good get restricted or limited, because we want rightness and goodness to flourish, so we want to restrict when people do things that aren't right and good. This causes political division and conflict, because we begin to see others as bad or evil, and they see us as bad or evil, because we might disagree on what is right and what is good. Taken a little further, we start to see other people as less human than ourselves. We start to see as their right to prosperity and land is less deserving than ours, because they are not right and good, but we are right and good, and we're trying to expand rightness and goodness. History shows that we will do this in an incredibly brutal good, and I know what's right and good. Well, I want the land and the goods for those who are right and good, and you deserve it less than I do. This can even include discrimination along lines of ability and disability, gender, race, and ethnicity. I think we have to get political when we look at the brokenness of the world. This passage in Mark, Jesus warns his disciples. Before he goes on the way with them to Jerusalem, he warns them very specifically, "Beware the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of those of Herod." This is political. There is a deep brokenness in the world. It is the yeast that is in the Pharisees. It is the yeast that is in those who follow Herod. And you need to be healed of it. When we hear this, when we feel this, there's a resistance that comes up in us, because we don't want to identify ourselves in this way that fits this kind of definition of brokenness, or the yeast of Pharisees and the yeast of those of Herod. This incredible spectrum begins with just the small stereotyping. Well, I know the kinds of people who aren't right and good, and they kind of look like this or they dress like that. When I was a teenager, it was long hair in men, or an earring in a man, or dressed in black. If you wear black earring, oh, hang on, I'm describing my brother. You would have stereotyped him as not sure I want to be around this young man. A little bit of stereotyping starts to become a little bit of discrimination. Now you start to see people of a certain type because they come from a certain background. You know, I think they're always going to be that way. I'm going to make things easier if I just kind of expect that that kind of person, that people group, is always going to act in a certain way. Discrimination starts to creep in because they're always going to do things less than good. Of course, if you go further along the line from discrimination, you come to segregation. I don't think we should live together. Push this line a little bit further, you come to apartheid. They don't deserve the same education we deserve. They don't know how to use it. Push this further, and now it's genocide. There is this brokenness in us. The stakes get higher, and the more that we're driven to see that the person who is wrong is a threat to what is good. The more that they are a threat to what is good, the greater justification for violence against them. Surely, though, not my team, not my country, not my group, we wouldn't behave this way. Not me. I don't want to look too closely at myself. I think the Pharisees felt this way very strongly when they met Jesus. You see, they had a little bit of experience with this just before, because John the Baptist came on the scene and he was saying, "Repent and believe." And so the Pharisees' response is, "Well, what do I do here? This man has come saying, 'Repent and be baptized.' And a bunch of people are saying, 'We are sinful, we need to be baptized.' So if I, as a Pharisee, who am one of the social, political, good people, join this line, I'm saying that actually I'm kind of sinful, and the work that I was doing before is kind of broken. So I'm not quite sure I can do that. Let me just wait and see how this plays out. Let me just watch for a little bit and see what this John the Baptist stuff turns into." And then Jesus comes on the scene, and Mark chapter 1 tells us what he proclaims. Jesus comes on the scene, and as a Pharisee, you're thinking, "Oh, shoot. We were supposed to be the ones who declare that, because we're the side of good and righteousness. So if there's a gentleman coming around saying that, and he's doing all kinds of healings, now we have to determine if he's actually from God or not. And if he is, and he's saying repent, then we would have to follow him and say, actually, we're very broken, and we don't know what we're doing, and we have to follow this man. They would have to commit political and social and spiritual suicide. Literally, I'm using that word because I think it would be that serious. The amount of dissonance that we have to come to say, I am so broken. What I was doing before, I thought was good and right and true, but it actually was just feeding and exploiting others so that I could have my pride fed. It was feeding my pride. It was feeding my greed. It was feeding my way of living where I get to be the person to see the brokenness in ourselves. It's so much easier to see it in others, to want to find scapegoats and to say the brokenness in our current community, in our neighborhood. It's because of this. It's out there. And if we could only just clean it up and fix it, that'd be great. But it's most definitely not in me. There's a brokenness that we don't want to admit to. Usually this happens more unconsciously than consciously. I don't think the Pharisees were like, well, if we follow Jesus, that's going to mean. I don't think that was that conscious. I think it was more of an unconscious response where they have to defend themselves by not repenting. The yeast of the Pharisees, the yeast of those who follow Herod, is the inability to know that you are, in fact, blind. That you see just a tiny spectrum of reality. That you can't see a whole amount of light that God sees, that God knows. That, in fact, you are blind. We resist this because of fear. It's going to cost me. We resist this because of anger. I'm mad at other people. I'm mad at the brokenness. We resist this because of greed. If I was to give up and recognize that there's brokenness in my team or in myself, I'm going to lose some things, possibly even my land. There's a resistance because of pride. We live in peace in a world that is this broken. We need to be healed. Now, you see, God can heal you of your broken leg, of your broken eyesight. He can heal you of your leprosy. We see this in the text. We have heard of Jesus' miracles. He touches people and he heals them. But what happens to that person 20, 30, 40 years down the road? They get old and die. Jesus can heal Lazarus, can call him out from the tomb, but he will, a few years later, or ideally many, die. Jesus can provide for you, can give you home and land and cars, but rust and dust and corrosion will be the end of all of those. Jesus can heal you for your health and for your wealth and for your prosperity, but this isn't the healing that you ultimately need. You need a second healing, fully healed. Not until Jesus had been crucified, resurrected, and ascended. And then they received the Spirit at Pentecost, and now they really understood. Now they were truly healed. Why does this text have two healings? I think traditionally, at least my experience in Sunday school, and perhaps yours was similar, we read this text, and Jesus laid his hands on this man a second time, and there's this word at the end that the man looked intently, and his sight was restored because he could now see clearly. Right? That implies that the first healing wasn't enough. That's weird. Really, really weird. I mean, all the stories I've heard in Sunday school, Jesus comes up and he says, get up, take your mat, and walk. In this one, the Lord, the creator of the universe, from Colossians we read, in him all things were created, things visible and things invisible. All things were created in him, for him, and through him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And then Jesus is working on your car with you, and he's under the hood of the car, and he's saying, I'll fiddle with this a little bit. Did that work? You know, started. Is that what's happening in this text? That the creator of the universe heals this man first by spitting in his face and then wiping his eyes with the spit, Can you see anything? Did that work? Did that take? Try starting it again. That didn't quite work. Okay, I'll go again. Is it because Jesus has a measure of power that he gives out? And on this man, he's like, I think it's like a 4 out of 10. Oh, okay, it was a little more. I needed a 5 or 6 because the first one didn't quite take it. This is silly. This can't be what's happening in this text. What does Jesus ask the man? Jesus asked the man, I think it's more appropriate to say, what do you see? Rather than can you see, rather than ability. When the man receives the first healing, he says he sees men or people like trees walking. Okay, so imagine this in your mind's eye. Jesus is in the middle of teaching, and he's not amplified, and so people are likely pretty close to him. And maybe he steps a little bit forward to the man who's blind. And he comes forward to and he says, what is it that you see now? And the man says, I see people like trees walking. Not a chance. Nobody's moving. When Jesus comes forward to heal this man, nobody is moving. Right? Imagine if I was to come and to try to heal somebody in this congregation today. Lay my hands on them, pray for them, and heal them. You're not flinching, you're not moving. Maybe you moved just before I performed the healing, and you came closer because you want to see, but once I ask the questions, what do you see now, or can you get up, you're not moving. So when this man first opens his eyes, there's not a chance, I think, that he sees people in motion. I think they're all stationary. What's going to happen next? So what does it mean to see people like trees? Have we heard this before? Is there any echoes in the Old Testament of people being spoken of like trees? And of course there is. Think of Psalm 1. Living water will bear fruit in season. And we see this elsewhere in the Old Testament where people are compared to trees who are fruitful. And Jesus picks up on this when he preaches, when he teaches. Bear good fruit. Judge a tree, judge a person by their fruit. So human beings can be thought of as trees because they produce fruit. What about walking? Well, Adam and Eve, remember, they walked with God in the Garden of Eden? But God doesn't have feet, legs. God doesn't walk like you or I walk. So they weren't walking in the garden the way that I would go for a walk in the garden with you. It meant they lived with God in the garden. And we think of Genesis 5, where Enoch walks with God. Similarly, Enoch lived in deep connection with God, as if it was to go for a walk with him. That's how close Enoch lived in relationship to God. So I think when this man first opens his eyes and he says, I see people like trees walking, Jesus is like, yep, you're seeing visible light, if you will. You're seeing human beings because human beings produce fruit and human beings live and walk. But it's not good enough. In order to live in them beings as those who live and walk, what we need is a second healing. And this second healing is very much tied to our brokenness, to our propensity, our inclination, our unconscious desires to follow the yeast of the Pharisees, the desire to control outcomes, to be free from God, to promote our own health and prosperity at the cost of others. It's a desire that will even reject Jesus if he says to us, this is what it costs to follow me. And you're like, you know what? I think that's a bit more than I'm willing to pay. This is the yeast of Pharisees working within us. We need to be healed. No matter how healthy you are in need of healing. When Jesus heals the man the second time, touches him the second time, it says that he was able to now see in a far-lighted or far-sighted way. He could see all things far-sighted or far-lighted. The word is a compound word, and it's one of those words that's only used once in the Bible. So we're just kind of like, I think it means this. And so that's why our interpreters, our translators are like, well, I think it means clearly. Well, how do you know it means clearly? Because it's used. It's a combination word, of far or end, telos, is the first part, and then the second part is light or sight. So far-lighted or end-sighted, or light that comes from the end, from the goal, from the purpose of all things. What we need is we need to be healed in such a way that we see all people around us under the light of God's ultimate redemption. We need a far-sighted light as a way of seeing this world. And it's only if we have this light that we're able to follow Jesus along the way, to take up our crosses, and to follow him. How do we live in peace in a world in which we find ourselves? How do we solve all the problems of darkness and evil? Is it by saying, we know what's right, and we're going to make fences so that only what's right is possible? Or is it by taking up a cross? Jesus means to take up a cross. He first tells us that those who want to follow me must take up a cross, deny themselves in order to follow me. He tells us that the first will be last. He tells us that you will have to receive me as though you would receive a child, and receive a child as though that child was me. Throughout the way, Jesus teaches his disciples and us what it means to follow him along the way. What does his cross mean? What does our cross mean? Perhaps as a Christian, you've heard these words before and you're not quite sure what they mean. What we're going to do through Lent is take the time to reflect on what it means for Jesus to take up the cross and for him to call us to follow him on the way, taking up our cross to follow him. Would you like to participate in the healing of the world? This is what is on offer before you. Would you like to know life even when the world and the space around you is so dark that you cannot see? Would you like to touch eternity and know that you are loved? Then I encourage you to come along the way and follow Jesus. Listen to him say, if any want to be my followers, follow me in this way. Everything else is an echo of the true goodness that we see in Jesus on his way to the cross. So I encourage you to come to taste and to see beyond the visible light, to follow Jesus along the way, and to receive the faith and the hope that is part of the long arc of history that is bending all things towards God's will. We see with far-sightedness the end lighting up the people before us. In great joy, we say amen.